You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk.
Talking sex.
I think Dr. Eve will probably agree that we need to change that. I think it's more sexuality, actually. There's so much more to this particular slot than just talking about sex. And today is a good example of that. We're going to be talking sex, sexuality, and reproductive justice for women and to young girls in this country, in our society. And I've got two guests with me that I have no doubt you will enjoy listening to and engaging as well on a range of issues under sex and reproductive laws. First and foremost, in our Cape Talk studio, I've got Marion Stevens, who's the chair of the Sexual and Reproductive Justice Coalition. Just saw a lekker tweet here of her looking very cushy down there in the Cape in the studio. Hello, Marion.
Hi, how's it, UCB?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good, long time. And thanks so much for inviting us to have this really important discussion. We don't get to talk about these issues.
Absolutely.
Much.
And you've done excellent work on this particular issue. I was just saying to Rebecca Hodes there, reproductive justice is something you keep reminding me should be part of expanded conversations. Also, a lovely picture there that I've just retweeted of you taking a lovely a picture there of yourself, a selfie in the Cape Talk studio, all the way in the Eastern Cape in East London, where I shouldn't share gossip, but I'm about to do that, where Rebecca says in East London every day is Sunday. So she's in very chilled vibes this morning. Is Dr. Rebecca Hodes, who's a medical historian at the University of Cape Town. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Yupi. Thank you for having me.
Have you gone to church? It is Sunday.
It's perpetually Sunday here, but I'm told that we mustn't be too down on East London. I'm told that some people are fine with calling it slummies, and others get very cross about that.
Marion,
so I guess it depends who you're talking to.
Absolutely. Marion, I'm going to start with you. Initially, when the team and I wanted to talk about women's right to terminate a pregnancy, an abortion on demand, we were interested in questions around, and we'll get to all of this, questions around the stigma, the shame, how difficult it is, whether the government, the state is doing enough to ensure that women are able to access an abortion on demand. But then I remembered the phrase that you often talk about on your social media platforms and even on my Facebook wall, which is reproductive justice. It is not part of our vocabulary the way the word abortion is. What is reproductive justice as a concept? Let's start there.
Sure. So reproductive justice is about 20 years old. It kind of formed around 1994 during the discussions that were leading up to the Cairo Conference on Population Development. And it came from African-American women and also from women in Asia, the Philippines. And what it was doing was it was taking the notions of choice and individual options and locating that within a context and looking at societal conditions that enable or limit women in particular to be able to exercise a choice. So women don't make choices in isolation. They come from communities, they come from families, they are, you know, contextual challenges that enable or limit being able to really, you know, work towards reproductive justice. So it also looks at, you know, issues of class and issues of, you know, historical imbalances and inequalities, which we in South Africa just are so familiar with. So in South Africa, it's a lot easier to talk about reproductive justice. And in fact, it's in some of the policies now in South Africa, the Adolescent Sexual and Reproductive Health Framework adopts a reproductive justice framework, and that is a inter-ministerial policy that's looking at combining the work of education, social development and health, and the women's ministry in looking at what are the material conditions that work towards enabling young girls and men, young boys, to be able to access a level of sexual and reproductive health autonomy.
Rebecca, the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Act is now about 21 years old. I'm very curious. I don't know if you've done research around this, but, you know, there's often a gap, as you know. The LGBTI jurisprudence is a classic example. We often have a gap between progressive, justice-centered legislation and the lived realities of women, of all sorts of vulnerable groups. When it comes to being able to have an abortion on demand during the first trimester, how much of this legislation is actually, in terms of the letter and spirit of the law, enacted and accessed by women and the girl child if she needs to?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? And I think Marion alluded to it. That abortion is, like homosexuality, one of those topics in South Africa which is so fascinating because of the discrepancies between what the law provides and then what is enacted, what is practiced and experienced by people within facilities, within their homes, leisure spaces, schools, public and private spaces. So, yeah, there is a vast discrepancy. What we have seen, and there's some really excellent evidence on this, is that there has been a decline in abortion-related mortality and morbidity as a result of the passing of the CHOICE Act, the Choice and Termination of Pregnancy Act. So we are seeing that fewer women are suffering from infections and illnesses and deaths because the CHOICE Act has been passed. But we're also in an interesting paradox and a kind of contradiction of the health effects that the CHOICE Act was meant to have had. We are also seeing persistent high rates of illegal terminations, that women are still seeking lamp post providers, seeking to end their unwanted pregnancies or unsupported pregnancies outside of the public health sector in illegal or unsafe ways. So perhaps Marion can speak to that a little bit more and explain why it is that so many women are still choosing or being forced to use the services outside of clinics, even though it's meant to be legal and accessible.
Marion?
I just want to kind of add some more information to what Rebecca's just said, and to actually say that the recent confidential maternal mortality survey actually showed that we are starting to see an increase of deaths from women from unsafe abortion. So following the passing of the law, and it's actually 20 years this year, February 1997,
okay.
We've now seen about 9.5% of maternal deaths from unsafe abortion. And that had gone down initially. And when we were doing really well in the 90s, we had about 60% of designated surgical abortion facilities operational. And now we're down to 40%. And we're starting to see the fallout in that it's extremely difficult. The Amnesty International meta-analysis that they did earlier on, and it was released around about the time of the anniversary of the Act, shows that only 7% of clinics in the country have any pathway to accessing abortion. So no wonder in work that we have done with adolescent women, they say, sure, we've got enough information about abortion. We just see the information everywhere, at the stations, on lampposts. Yeah, we know what to do. And essentially what we've done is we have made accessible illegal abortion. Because we're not actually implementing our law, and we don't actually know what's happening other than through the deaths that we're seeing through our every 3 years we measure maternal deaths, and we're certainly seeing a rise and an increase now. So as I said, 9.5% of maternal deaths from unsafe abortion.
So what is the problem? Is there not enough resources that the state is providing to actually make this now almost 20-year-old act an act that women can say, yes, we actually experience reproductive justice in this regard? Or is it attitudinal problems? Is it shame and stigma to approach public health facilities? Or is it all of that?
There are a range of systemic issues, and I often get asked now since the new Trump presidency, you know, is everything gone pear-shaped? Well, actually, it's gone pear-shaped since 2000, since Bush came in, because then we saw a very particular change in direction from our Department of Health, where they stopped, you know, the meetings where we would look at the designated facilities. They stopped the concerted effort at training of providers. they didn't put through medical abortion guidelines through our National Department of Health. There are two different ways that you can have an abortion. You can have a medical abortion where you take tablets, and you can have a surgical abortion where you have a procedure. Sometimes they combine the methods, but they're two distinct methods. Now, the Western Cape is the only province where they've passed medical abortion guidelines. And so the rest of the country is it's kind of pretty much willy-nilly. Mm. And we've seen from the, you know, there's been a lot in the media recently published around, you know, the looking at the health facilities, and there are terrible issues are in relation to cleanliness, things working, how things function, repairs, the compliance. I think it's a recent study that was done internally. So we're seeing that our health systems are really struggling. Added on top of that, as Rebecca says, you've got a marginalized and a stigmatized service in relation to people's sexuality and sexual and reproductive health. Mm. And so people have do not have the same willingness and engagement when doing HIV testing and handing out treatment for, you know, ARVs as they do in terms of giving medical abortion drugs. In fact, some health providers will object to handing out medical abortion pills.
Does the law allow them to conscientiously object?
Yes, there's a clause which basically says you can object, but you have to refer. And that is a huge hole in the law because the referral pathway and the management of human resources is not well done. And so what will happen is you'll get somebody applying for a job, and it will be like a reproductive health nurse or you work in gynecology, and you can actually say, no, I'm not going to do abortions. We don't do this in this facility. So that is why we only have 40% of the designated facilities operational.
Okay, 19 minutes after 11, let's take a break. If you're listening to the conversation, that voice you just heard there was that of Marianne Stevens, the chairperson of Sexual and Reproductive Justice Coalition. And before that, you would have heard the voice of academic Dr. Rebecca Hodes, who's a medical historian. But here's my question to you as you are listening to this conversation. If you are a woman in particular, what has been your experience of the public health sector when it comes to accessing an abortion if you wanted to terminate a pregnancy? Was it easy? Was it difficult? What has been your interaction with some of the health workers, both in the private and the public sector, by the way? Obviously, the state has its primary duty to make these available for especially poor women who can't afford other ways of accessing an abortion on demand. So I'm very curious to know what your lived experiences are. It's now been some 20 years since abortions have been legal. It doesn't mean that reproductive justice is a reality. If you've got questions for Rebecca or Marion, you can also give us a call on 011-883-0702 and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567.
702 and Cape Talk.
Talking Sex.
I'm focusing today, if you've just joined us, on reproductive justice for women. My two guests are Marianne Stevens and also Dr. Rebecca Hodes. Rebecca, let's widen the conversation a little bit. I mean, if part of the reason why the number of designated facilities that are supposed to be providing the abortions are woefully low at around 50% or so, and one of the reasons, as many people like Marianne have pointed out, Amnesty as well, is a values gap between doctors and nurses and the legislation that is now been on the statute books for, you know, two decades. How does one begin to deal with something like that, where you have a deeply conservative society, you may have culturally informed or, I don't know, religiously based convictions about the status of a fetus, for example? How do we tackle that from a health point of view?
Well, traditionally, some of the ways that we've made inroads here in South Africa is through something called values clarification. It sounds a little bit Orwellian, but in essence, what it means is that experienced abortion providers and reproductive rights advocates, nurses, and women come together and they thresh out some of the contestations and the difficulties with providing abortion or accessing it. And I think maybe that's something that we should be able to grapple with ourselves, because for many women and for many providers, abortion isn't an easy thing, and it's not a unpleasant experience. Now, I think it's troublesome because we don't want to insist that women experience trauma as a result of an abortion. We want to make this as untraumatic as possible, but we also want to accept that a lot of women are uncomfortable with this, that a lot of men are, and that a lot of nurses and healthcare providers and doctors are as well. So yeah, let's be honest about that. Let's confront the difficulties of the procedure and then work on making it easier, making it less painful and more accessible. I think what's happened is that within clinics, nurses have taken on this role of being moral arbiters, and they often make the experience more painful or will do that through ways such as withholding analgesics. And an excellent study done on second trimester abortions in South Africa, the largest study of its kind, found that in the majority of cases, a lot of women were not being given basic pain blockers while they were undergoing a second trimester abortion. So there are ways that women are being indirectly and directly punished and made to suffer as a result of this. So if I could just come to one of Marion's points, Eusebius, because it's something that is often talked about on your program, this issue of who is responsible, which governments are responsible. This is a matter of, you know, the international development and national development. In South Africa, we had 606 billion rands dedicated to health expenditure from National Treasury in 2017. So we have a clear commitment and a lot of resources nationally to tackle these healthcare issues. But I think speaking about people like Donald Trump, about changes in international aid, they are crucial, but they also don't hold African governments to account as they should. Now, we're looking at health expenditure. African countries committed to expending 15% of their budgets within the Abuja targets on health. How many are actually doing that? Should we be blaming international aid agencies, or should we be looking and scrutinizing national treasury, provincial departments of health, district health officials for how it is that they are spending their money and how they are not improving services as they should?
Absolutely. Let's take a couple of calls, and then I'll come back to you in a second, Marion, on the values question as well, to add to what Bex is saying. Andrew, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, and thank you for the topic. I just had one comment with regards early medical termination of pregnancy. The National Department of Health has got guidelines. They are available on their website and are part of their standard treatment guidelines, which fortunately is now also available on apps. So there's no excuse for healthcare workers not to have access to guidelines for medical termination. But I think the problem is not the guidelines, not commitment from higher up, but at the actual facilities and the experience women face when they come to our facilities. Facilities are often overcrowded. They value judgments made. They're seen as extra work and unnecessary extra work. And just outside a very large maternity facility in Johannesburg, they are daily based. Weekly, we find babies dumped in the dustbins outside that have actually had terminations outside of the facility. And it's easy to find. There are posters all over the facility, in fact, advertising alternative services. So until we make the facilities user-friendly, sympathetic, and easily accessible to these women, they will go elsewhere where they aren't judged, where they don't have to go through the public health system, and we will be losing them.
Marion, I mean, this values issue is very important, right? Because sometimes lawmakers, advocates, we forget that some of these conversations, like as with gay rights analogy that Rebecca used, they also implicate our deeply personal values that we have and that we are committed to. How do we get a public service when it comes to reproductive justice for women, so that we can have public service on the part of health professionals that both respects their right to go to work with their values intact, but also respect the rights of women?
So we work quite closely. In fact, one of the members on our steering committee is a medical student at UKZN and works with the South African medical students. And they feedback to us quite regularly about how appalling their education is in relation to abortion. They're not given enough time to understand the procedure. They're not given enough clinical hours to become skilled. So it's quite interesting as well in terms of the Fees Must Fall movement. Some of the medical students are also saying that we need to decolonize our medical school curriculum, nurses as well. There are nurses that have contacted me as well saying we are not properly trained. And it's interesting, Rebecca uses the word Orwellian. I mean, it's extraordinary that we have to clarify values. I was involved in a project in the early 90s at WITS called the Health Workers for Change, where we actually looked at changing and transforming our care in relation to reproductive health. And we worked in three different provinces and looked at what providers' attitudes and feelings were in relation to their own concerns and beliefs around sexuality and reproduction. And so we've got a field where you've got to start with nurses and doctors as they train and also with the existing services. And it's in a relation of, related area. So, there's also kind of workshops that I've done around, sexual orientations and diverse gender identities, that you actually have to really look at this extremely conservative mindset, and also noting that lesbian women also might want to request an abortion, and trans men as well. So we're not just talking about women; we're talking about a service that is needed, that our law provides. And as Rebecca says as well, our health budget contributes 12% of our budget on health, but what is happening to it? We've got a good figure. And, what is happening between Treasury and the Department of Health? How are the priorities kind of working? I know, Andrew, I'd be very surprised. I think you might be in Gauteng. And I'd be very keen if you could pass on the URL, because we searched the Department of Health's website. If you search abortion or termination of pregnancy, nothing comes up.
Let's take a quick break there, Marianne, just for news headlines. Also, I'll go to the calls again after the break. Dr. Tlakleng, I do notice you as well.
702 and Cape Talk.
Talking sex.
24 minutes before noon today, we are focusing on reproductive justice. Let's go back to the lines. I think it is Dr. Tlakleng who's actually on the line. Thank you so much for your patience.
Hi, Yusuf. So I just want to speak to the issue of conscientious objection.
Yes.
I think when people enroll to become doctors or nurses or, be in the health profession, they really have no place to choose or decide which part of a woman is worthy of care. And I think this has been such a terrible idea that has been forced largely by anti-choice groups, where they actually teach medical students how to actually get away with not providing care. I think it's dishonorable. I think it's disgusting. And I think, in fact, if the National Department of Health and maternal mortality, they would actually take a bigger step and more active in making sure that the clinics are well-stocked, the nurses and doctors are well-trained, and everyone knows how the referral system should work. And it's funny for me because, with abortion care, it's the only area in medicine where suddenly people find their conscience. No one finds anything wrong with neurosurgeons who are operating day in and day out of drunk drivers who have wiped out entire families on the road. When those drunk drivers come to hospitals, they get good care, they get ethical care standards, they go to surgery, they have everything done for them. But when it comes to women and our reproductive care needs, suddenly the whole world finds their moral compass.
Absolutely.
And I think it's actually quite disgusting. If you're a health professional and you think you have a right to determine who gets to live and who gets to die simply because suddenly you have found your morals, then you shouldn't be in the health field. And quite honestly, I'm just sick and tired of this conscientious objection, which in fact is not even in the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act. It appears elsewhere in the Constitution, but it's actually not part of the Act. And people have been taught how to actually bring that conscientious objection clause into abortion care.
Beautifully put. Thank you so much for that, Doctor. Really appreciate it. Thank you for calling in. Jody, good morning and welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm happy to be here. My comment, I would like to touch on what both Brian and Dr. T had just said now regarding conscientious objector. So it is true. There is no provision in the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act that speaks about conscientious objector. It is found in the Constitution, whereby you have the right to exercise your conscience, your belief, and your religion. And somehow that has found its place in the implementation of abortion. And what we found is that that actually causes a barrier in women who also have an individual choice to choose to have a termination of pregnancy, which is legislated for. But a conscientious objector, they cause a barrier in whereby they will state and they invoke their right to conscience and therefore deny a woman access to termination of pregnancy services. Mm. Now, that is a huge issue. And what I do recommend is that the National Department of Health actually regulate conscientious objectors to actually state when someone can conscientiously object and when they can't, and, you know, what are the guidelines around that? Because at the moment, there's so much confusion. People don't know what it means. People don't know how to implement it. People don't even know how to respond when a healthcare worker say that they are a conscientious objector, even when they are placed in a facility that provides the service of a termination of pregnancy.
Jody, the practical difficulty, obviously, with any form of conscientious objecting in this conversation or any other topic is the inherent difficulty of saying to someone, we do not believe that you are authentic in telling us that this goes against your values. So conscientious objecting is a trump card someone can use, even if they are squeamish. But I don't think it's really going to be easy for the state to regulate it. But something caught my attention when Marion was pointing out that the state still has to make the facility available, and that healthcare professional who is conscientiously objecting, we may respect their values, but they still need to be able to refer you to where you can, in fact, access your service.
Yeah, but you see, it's all linked. So what happens is that the state has a list of designated facilities, right? But that doesn't mean that those facilities are operational. So if they have a designated facility and the client goes to one of those facilities, they find that it's actually not operational because there's someone that's supposed to be providing a service that says that they're objector.
So what do we do in that scenario, Marion?
So, you know, the reality is that the Department of Health needs to work on its referral pathway and to make sure that health workers cannot refuse and they cannot object and that they make a pathway for women. And I think we're waiting for a legal case because women are dying, because we're seeing too many of, as Andrew was referring to, concealment of births, late terms births that are happening. And it's just completely unacceptable in 2017, 20 years after our democracy, that in particular black women are suffering. You know, middle class women and middle class black women, you know, can access the private sector. But it is poor people, and this is why it's a reproductive justice issue. And it's interesting, you know, I have been looking at the literature and doing some research, and people are not talking about conscientious objection anymore. They're calling it dishonorable disobedience. That's the language that's coming out of Europe. Because it's actually, one cannot tolerate this. This is at a whim. The state has an obligation to provide. You know, we know that there's a progressive realization of rights in relation to our constitution. But what does that mean in, you know, with regard to reproductive health? Absolutely. We've got poor contraceptive services. We've got poor comprehensive sexuality education. And the fallout is that women will always need abortion because contraception is, you know, not always 100%. We've got huge endemic sexual violence as well. Women will have unsupported, unintended, and unwanted pregnancies and will need to opt to make this choice. And the state has the obligation to provide, and they have to get their management of human resources ready so that if you employ somebody, they will make sure the doors are opened and not closed. They will have drugs in their facilities. Recently in Gauteng, there was a stockout of mifepristone, the abortion, medical abortion drug. But it didn't get to the news. It was just some kind of bureaucratic issue. Mm. How is that possible in Gauteng?
Sure. 17 minutes before noon, let's take a quick break. Rebecca, on the other side of this, I want to ask, where do boys and men come into this conversation? This is an issue that affects all of us. It takes two to tango, and I have been, I think, objectionably so, speaking of objections, framing this as being about reproductive justice for women. But of course, there are also responsibilities and duties, ethical and otherwise, that fall on us as boys and as men, even before a woman finds herself in the invidious position of looking for a facility where she can access an abortion.
702 and Cape Talk.
Talking sex.
Rebecca, I want to ask where boys and men come. I mean, the two things I want to do in the 5-6 minutes we have left. The first is, where do boys and men fit into this conversation?
Well, I think boys and men are everywhere here, UB, because, of course, women don't become pregnant immaculately, despite what some old books may have to say. The women that we see in these facilities are pregnant because they've had unprotected sex, whether that's been wanted or not, whether it's been voluntary and or coerced. But women are pregnant because men are fathers. And so what we have seen occasionally, very, very occasionally, is men coming to facilities to be there to support their girlfriends or their partners through a termination of pregnancy. But that is extremely rare. Within 4 months of working in an abortion facility, I only saw one case of a boyfriend or husband who was there to support his partner. So I think abortion here is often the agency of the boy or the man is an impetus behind the woman, because, you know, if the pregnancy is unwanted or unsupported, the insistence for the procedure might be coming from the male partner. But there again, there is an issue of blaming. If this was an act of sex that was voluntary and desired rather than coerced, it is a matter of two people deciding to do something, and then one person really potentially having to bear the consequences for that. I think women ultimately are the ones who have to go through a pregnancy, give birth to the child, and then continue to have a often disproportionate degree of responsibility for raising that child. And I guess that's a matter of biology and a matter of society and many other factors that come into that. What we have seen is men refusing paternity, which is a matter of, which is often a reason that women have abortions. What I've noticed in speaking to illegal providers is that, so contrary to this allegation that women are being irresponsible for their unwanted pregnancies, what a number of these illegal providers explained was that women had come for an illegal abortion because of love. The word that they used was love, because they had to prove to their romantic partners, the men in their lives who had impregnated them, that they loved the man and they loved him enough to terminate the pregnancy that they had created together. So there are all kinds of emotions and commitments and ideals and values that are bound up within this vexed issue. And I think that the trouble is declaring that men or boys are one particular thing. We must really move away from insisting that they're all the same. There's a lot of difference and variety and complexity here.
Absolutely. Marion, I want to ask you the same question, and let's make it very practical. You are a very present and conscious mom. You think about boys and how one has to raise them. I mean, you know, sort of two questions here, and I want to keep it very, very practical. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of conversations we need to have with boys, and that we need to have as men amongst ourselves and with boys in our care, be it our kids, siblings, or mentees that we have, that can make this world a world in which girls and women experience reproductive justice?
Indeed, and you met my boys when they were very young. And
they're,
I think,
stunning.
They were talking to you about patriarchy, and I think that at a transgender conference.
That's right. And yeah.
And I think that that's what one has to start talking about is patriarchy, because, you know, not all men, not all blacks, not all whites, not all whatevers. Men, the issue is patriarchy. And my children, that's what I've spoken to them about where their bodies begin and where their bodies end in relation to whoever, whatever partners they might choose. And that already they know what a condom is, a male condom and a female condom is, and how you use it. And as a man, that's the tool that you have besides talking. And, Rebecca's point about denied paternity being the most common reason that women suggest that they why they want to have an abortion, and especially when they have later term abortions, is a huge issue. And denied paternity relates to patriarchy, relates to men having power over women, and not taking responsibility for the act of fathering, the act of a 2-second ejaculation, which results into a pregnancy, whether consensual or not, and going into making somebody become a mother, which takes a lifetime, and not engaging with the act of possible parenting. And so there's a lot to be said there.
Absolutely.
And we haven't even got to trans men.
Anyway, we will definitely get to that in a future segment. I want to bring Professor Kopano back as well to talk about how to raise the boy child in a feminist manner. And I think some of us as dads and men needs to be re-raised as well to understand some of these issues much better. But for now, time has just flown by. Marian, as always, you've been excellent. Thank you for your commitment to social justice. And the same to you as well, Rebecca. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone.
Have a great day.